today. We've talked a lot about physical health when it comes to COVID-19, but what is this crisis doing to our mental health? Going into the Guardian's old-fashioned, slightly cramped Westminster office every day in early March was part of the reason that John Crace started to feel anxious about COVID-19 early on.
We were beginning to get emails from NHS England saying, you know, there have been two recorded deaths. It was back in the very early days of the virus. I still was sort of really scared.
But our parliamentary sketch writer knew that he would find this looming threat particularly hard to handle.
I've always, you know, suffered from sort of health anxiety, you know, quite badly anyway. And I was sort of going into the office hoping that people would just be saying, oh, look, typical John, he's sort of, you know, being his usual hypochondriacal self. And actually, I found that a lot of other people were feeling the same way as me. Reality had caught up with my own anxiety.
COVID-19 poses the worst threat to the country's physical well-being in generations. But the fear of this disease and the drastic measures taken to limit its spread mean there's another worry about its impact on our mental health. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what COVID-19 means for our mental health. John, you were clearly very worried about going to work in Westminster. When did you stop doing that?
I had to go in for the budget on the 11th of March, but from the next day, I decided I don't think it's worth it to my health and also kind of my mental health as well, because it was really stressing me out, the thought of being ill.
That was actually quite early on. I feel like the rest of us caught up with you more than a week later when Boris Johnson announced the lockdown.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
It was weird. I mean, there were moments that week when I suddenly burst out crying and I saw the same all around me. Was that a glimpse of how you were feeling all the time through that period?
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, building up to that. And also the Monday and Tuesday, I just couldn't work. I could barely get out of bed. I was sort of like lying in bed, trying to force myself out to kind of engage, but I just couldn't. And one of the advantages of having a sort of long record as a sort of mental health patient is that at least I knew where to go. And since then, I've been having three sessions on the phone with my therapist a week, plus talks with my psychiatrist who has altered my medication. And that has made a difference. I kind of feel probably now that I am living at a level of anxiety that is just about tolerable and, you know, I can function on. Whereas actually for about 4 or 5 days, I couldn't function at all.
Tell me what it feels like when you're lying in bed feeling like that. What is it? Describe the anxiety to me.
It's weird because it's not just help, I feel terrified and anxious. It's a real physical experience as well. I get this sort of ball of fear in my stomach that sort of curls me up into a fetal position. And I feel pain down my arms, across the top of my back and in my legs as well. It's almost like the sort of the muscles are being stretched to breaking point. It becomes a sort of, I've got to get myself out of bed. I've got to get, and I can't do it. And I would then say, okay, I've got to try and do something. And I would sort of go off and do 20 press-ups just to try and relieve the tension in the shoulders, you know, just to try and replace, you know, the cortisol levels, you know, stress levels with some endorphins or something.
What was it about this crisis that was making that so bad?
I think the fact that it was so global, it was sort of intangible, and you know, and it was really an exercise in true powerlessness. There was no way that you could make sure that you were safe. And now I try and keep my life as small as possible, almost, and to try and think in terms of what I've got to do in the next half hour, hour, you know, what I'm going to sketch today, because I find the big questions are just too heartbreaking. I mean, my daughter, who lives in Minneapolis, first of all, she was going to be coming over in May. Obviously, that's not going to happen. And then, you know, my son is down in Brighton. And in a way, he might as well be in the US as well, because, you know, we can't see him either. Then there's my mother as well. My mother has been in a care home for the last 3 years. The care home were being brilliant. They went into sort of lockdown 3 weeks ago, saying no visitors from outside. So I haven't been able to visit my mum. But last Thursday, we got an email from them saying that they had a suspected case of coronavirus in the home. So for the last week or so, my mum has been sort of basically confined in her room, and she is sort of lonely and she's frightened. And again, I have no idea when I'll next see her.
So those are the big questions.
Yeah, those are the really big questions. And, you know, there are no easy, comfortable answers to any of them.
We've never lived through anything like this before. What does it do to the brain when your life dramatically changes in circumstances like this?
The impact on our brain and more generally on our psychology can be quite profound.
Dr. Antonis Kasoulis is the England and Wales Director of the Mental Health Foundation and a leading expert in this field.
The instinctive response is a response of stress, and stress is recorded in a place of the brain that's called amygdala, and the more protracted and excessive that stress is, the more it impacts on our behavior, on our responses, and on also our long-term responses to circumstances that will in the future feel similar, even though not exactly the same.
So what you were saying is that when a huge crisis like this hits, the stress it causes has a physical impact.
Yes. If you look into how we've seen mental health and physical health in the past, it's a little bit unhelpful that we have this distinction between the mind and the body. They're actually, you know, we're actually people, and these are different aspects of who we are. So what impacts on our brain, impacts on our bodies, what impacts on our psychology, impacts on our bodies, and vice versa.
Is there any way to understand yet the potential mental health impact of this?
We can make assumptions on the basis of how things, situations like that have been in the past. A lot of people talk about the 1918 pandemic, in that it had huge scale. It seems to have had an impact on hospitalizations, on first episodes of psychosis and other mental health problems, and also on suicides potentially.
Clearly, one of the big impacts on people's mental health will be the fear of the disease itself. But there's also how we've responded to it, the lockdown. What is it about that that contributes to poorer mental health?
It's very much associated with loss at a very fundamental level, loss of identity, of the roles that we have. So the first thing that, you know, a quarantine situation takes away from us is who we actually are on a day-to-day basis. So we are members of our families, we are parents or siblings or partners, and we may not be able to see family for some time. We are working, we're employees or running businesses or studying, And this is hugely disrupted at the moment. We have our hobbies, things that we will do after work, things we will do in the weekends or anything like that. And again, we are not able to do that. There's very little things we can do actually in terms of hobbies in isolation. That feeling of identity, understanding who we are and investing in that is quite fundamental to our psychology and well-being. And losing that can be really significantly stressful for each one of us.
I've just been reading a report from UCL where they're tracking the experience of tens of thousands of people and looking at mental health in particular. So it shows that if you've got a mental health diagnosis, then the levels of stress as a result of COVID are much higher than if you haven't. It might seem an obvious question, but why is that?
This is an important point to raise. I think ever since the pandemic started sweeping around the world and we started talking about this specific condition, we've talked a lot about vulnerability and we've heard a lot about physical vulnerabilities in the sense of underlying conditions. There has been very little talk about mental health vulnerabilities. And people who have that experience of stress or depression or trauma or maybe things like OCD in their past, they are exposed to circumstances that could be quite triggering for them. People with depression or post-traumatic stress disorder asked to stay at home. This may be reminding them of a time when they were staying at home because of their illness. So it will not be an easy time there. People with OCD, so obsessive and compulsive behaviors, this messaging around washing your hands, this could be quite triggering again to some of the behaviors that they've been trying to recover from. It's the same with anxiety and the stress that comes with it. It's almost impossible to escape if you're stressed already.
John, can you explain the history of your struggles with mental health?
Well, I was always anxious as a child. In my 20s, I self-medicated with heroin for 10 years as a kind of form of isolation from the world, really, a kind of just numb out, blank everything out, have no feelings about anything. Got clean 33 years ago. But then the sort of anxiety and depression sort of came back to really kick me. I ended up in a psychiatric hospital. And ever since then, I've been under medical, you know, or mental health supervision. And plus, I've always seen a therapist. I'm still seeing the same therapist now who I saw 32 years ago.
How do you feel for people who can't get that type of help right now?
I feel desperate for, I mean, I don't know where I would be. I mean, if, you know, it sounds dramatic, but if I'd still had to live at the intensity of the fear that I felt for that 5 days before I managed to get in touch with both my therapist and my psychiatrist, and I'd had to sort of live with that for another 3 weeks, I'm not sure I'd have coped. And I'm not sure my wife would have coped. I mean, you know, it's sort of terrifying for her too.
You mentioned that you were almost paralysed by the anxiety for those 5 days and things have improved a bit. I mean, just tell me about your days now.
Well, the mornings are still by far the worst. It often takes me, even now, it can take me 2 hours to get out of bed in the morning. You know,
Two hours?
Yeah, I will wake up. At about seven and think, okay, I've got to get on with the day. But a bit of me will be just unable to get out of bed. It's like there's some kind of gravitational force that won't allow me to move. But then eventually I kind of get out of bed, start to sort of try and engage. I mean, the other weird thing about all this is that in previous anxiety bouts, work has often proved to be quite a useful distraction. But it's sort of harder these days because, you know, the news is the very thing that is making me so anxious. My wife and I have had this new rule that sort of after 6 o'clock, we don't watch anything on the news because I know that whatever has happened, is almost certainly going to have been bad.
Coming up, what can people who are suffering right now do to ease the pain? Antonis, we know this is a crisis that isn't going to hit everyone equally. Is it possible that it will actually exacerbate inequality?
Absolutely. We do know that poverty is a big factor impacting on their mental health. We do know that various socioeconomic inequalities are also a big factor. So in simple terms, the poorer you are, if you like, the higher the chance that you would have a physical or a mental health condition. So one of the first things that we wanted to really talk about in the pandemic is, you know, we saw some celebrities and some high profile people saying this is the great equalizer, you know, this will make us all equal because we all have a risk of falling. That's actually not true. We see people from various communities living in more crowded households. They are disproportionately affected by illness, by bereavement, and also by these mental health struggles linked to non-stable jobs or not great connection with the family.
Presumably, if you're from a low-income household, you may not be able to access some of the therapies that you need as easily.
No, and this is disrupted for many people. Again, one of the main risks we saw early on was that a lot of the services that are provided by charities, for example, or by the NHS were disrupted. A lot have moved online now, a lot have moved digitally, and this is great. And we see a big effort from the government to fund some of these services as well. Again, really useful tools, but the evidence shows they're not offering the same benefits as physical one-to-one therapy or group therapy.
And in terms of other groups who might be particularly vulnerable, I'm interested in those who are living on their own. I mean, it's a long time to go without physical touch or real interaction with other people. What impact does that have?
It is a long time to go. And I think this is also exacerbated by the fact that we actually don't know, when the end is. And this adds to loneliness. Loneliness that is excessive, so it's felt like isolation, it's experienced as being isolated from friends, family, colleagues, and that is also protracted, so it lasts for a long time. That can be quite toxic for our well-being.
And then there are the people who are most exposed to the horrors of COVID-19, for example, those working in care or in the NHS. And what are your concerns about those groups?
So this could be quite traumatic for people working in those circumstances. And it's something we really need to think about. And even though we don't seem to have a lot of good research from past pandemics, we do have some research about hospitalization in the intensive care units and the trauma that comes with it, but also working in these units and the trauma that comes with it. And this could have much longer lasting effects on mental health, which we should really be thinking about right now, really.
So what on earth can people do if they're struggling, especially given how real many of these impacts are? People really are losing their jobs. They really can't see their loved ones. It genuinely is a struggle to buy food.
I would say that given how extraordinary these circumstances feel, I would start with just trying to do the basics when you can. Eating, sleeping, moving, keeping hydrated, you know, just the fundamentals of our survival and their mental health. They can seem overwhelming, but we need to keep them in as a routine. Accepting that we are actually worthy of support, accepting that we may need to ask for help, is a really important step in those circumstances. And there will be helplines, there will be online services or phone services, and the GPs have moved some of their appointments by phone as well. Building a circle of support and investing in that, making sure that we stay in touch with friends and family, and maintaining connections, even when it seems hard, that'll be really important. We should be thinking about physical distancing, but not social distancing. We need to stay close to each other. I think any experiences of coping that we have from the past, now is the time to remember those. Now is the time to bring any techniques that we know, even simple, you know, we may like coloring or music, you know, simple stuff. I would say limiting our exposure to the news and social media might be important if people are struggling with that. There's this huge, you know, nonstop 24/7 exposure. And I think there's also something about being part of our community. There's something about altruism and how doing good does good for us as well. And so people who can volunteer locally, like delivering food, working dogs, for example, that might be really good for them.
I'm interested in exercise, because clearly that's something that people feel can help. John certainly told us it could help him. Mm. Other countries have gone further than us in their lockdowns. They've stopped people from going out for a single piece of exercise a day. Our government has suggested that they want that to continue because of mental health concerns. How much of a difference does that make?
It actually makes a lot of difference. We do know that from research and you know, over many, many years, we do know that physical activity is very beneficial for our mental health and well-being. It is one of the key things that we can do to promote our mental health. It doesn't need to be anything complicated. It could be just everyday things like walking, climbing stairs, running, walking a dog. That is quite fundamental. We do know that when we exercise, there is a release of good mood hormones in our brain. And we also know that it's also a release of stress hormones. So we would be less stressed, less angry. I do see how other countries have limited that. But it's quite important for us in any kind of circumstances that we can to try to keep moving and exercising. The best kind of exercise, the one that you might enjoy. I think that, you know, that's my main advice.
Are there any measurements yet of the impact of this? Do we know if self-harm has increased, for example, or suicide?
Our own research is quite useful for us, because we can also compare to before the lockdown. We started collecting data before the lockdown. We see suicidal thoughts emerging as an issue. We don't know what the impact will be in the longer term, but there is a concern that the combination of trauma and general worries, financial worries and isolation may have an impact on suicide. So we are seeing some early signs that this might be the case. I think we shouldn't underestimate both how significant the mental health impact might be and also how long it might last. And in many ways, it will last longer than the pandemic itself, than the physical health impact of the pandemic.
John, the lockdown is reaching the end of its fifth week now and has just been extended. How have you been coping?
It's basically minute by minute, really. Well, there are two terms that I've become really useful from my early days in Narcotics Anonymous, when an addict would say, "I just don't know if I can last out a whole week without doing any drugs." And the answer would all come back, "Just take it one day at a time. Just try and stay clean for the rest of the day and see what tomorrow brings. You may feel differently tomorrow." And the other is the recognition of the sheer powerlessness of that, you know, when you are in the grip of addiction, you are powerless over it, really. You know, it grips you and you sort of lose the ability to think, feel, do everything. And also, and that's sort of the way with the coronavirus. I mean, you are literally powerless over it. I mean, I can take as many steps as possible to keep myself safe, socially distanced, live responsibly. But, you know, you just literally don't know.
That was our parliamentary sketchwriter John Crace and Dr. Antonis Kosilis, the England and Wales director of the Mental Health Foundation. If you're finding things difficult at the moment, then there is help out there. In the UK, the Samaritans are available 24 hours a day on 116 123 or by emailing joe@samaritans.org. I mentioned an interesting study from UCL during this episode being led by Dr. Daisy Fancourt. Antonis himself is carrying out some fascinating research in collaboration with Cambridge University and others. Do look both of them up. As for John Crace, he may be easing off on his news consumption in the evenings, but he is very much still writing his brilliant sketches. I did enjoy a recent one declaring Piers Morgan the voice of the nation. Who would have thought? Do read his pieces at theguardian.com and all the other reporting on COVID-19. That's it for today. My thanks to John Crace and Antonis Kosoulis. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you're all coping okay with lockdown. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.